Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hello, movie truthers. Welcome to this week's episode of Truth and Movies. I'm Layla Latif.
I'm David Jenkins.
And I'm Lillian Crawford.
On the show this week, Ezra Miller helms The Flash. Masculinity is explored in Pretty Red Dress, and we spoke to director Dion Edwards. And on Film Club, it's gender-bending cult classic Glenn or Glenda. All coming up on Truth and Movies, a Little White Lies podcast. Lillian Crawford, my dear friend, so good to have you back.
It's a pleasure to be here.
And tell us, what have you been up to? You're always up to something interesting and exciting.
I wish I had been. I haven't been up to much exciting. I was at the Film on Film Festival at the BFI all weekend, which was rather wonderful, especially as it's been so very, very hot and the air conditioning was on full blast in there. So that was a nice escape from the heat.
Well, they needed to keep it cool because they were screening Nitrate Prince and there was a kind of death rattle over the screenings, but in a good way.
Yes, although I was told that it needed to get to 30 degrees in the projection booth for it to actually burst into flames and have a sort of Cinema Paradiso situation. So I was pleased that didn't happen, but they had some really gorgeous prints. I think Service for Ladies, which is a 91-year-old print, was my highlight. That was particularly wonderful.
I enjoyed Blood and Sand, the Ruben Mamoulian Nitrate print. Very, very gorgeous, rich, painterly colours. But just an amazing atmosphere. I mean, you know, I think it's worth us talking about just a little bit because, you know, we hope that it would kind of come back next year in a kind of bigger, more expanded form. So, you know, anyone listening here, the hype is real. We want it now. We want it a bit more, larger, longer, all that.
Yeah, absolutely.
More combustible.
Yes. More dangerous film festivals, please.
Yeah.
Don't really know how to segue into the new issue. But, I mean, yeah, there's other exciting things afoot. We've got a new issue. And, David, I've got to ask you about this cover. I mean, it's like it's gorgeous, but it's like hand-stitched felt. Is that right?
Yeah. This was like, you know, I think when we're making Little White Lies, the sort of print edition, I think we're always trying to think of some kind of like concept that kind of runs through every issue. And I think just one of the things that we enjoy the most is making things by hand. And so we kind of had this idea early on of one of the things that Wes Anderson likes to do in his films a lot is he has these kind of, you know, the way he uses special effects in particular is very, very kind of like handicraft style. And, you know, he uses like felt and cotton, and, you know, he's not using CGI. I mean, or if he probably is using CGI, but in very, very kind of subtle, invisible ways. So we kind of jumped on this idea of like, well, let's make this issue feel like a sort of tactile object, and like we want people to be able to see the craft. And it was kind of interesting because, like, initially when we did it, when we were looking at PDFs on a screen, you'd maybe look at it and you wouldn't notice it. Like you'd have to really look hard at the image and be like, oh god, that's actually a real thing that's been made. And I think that's one of the beauties of like actual physical print, is that now if you see the real magazine, it's kind of unequivocal, you see it and it's obvious that it's like a real thing. And yeah, that was the result of an amazing, I believe, she's either in New England or Connecticut. It's that kind of northern bit of sort of eastern seaboard in the US. And she's called Ali Mack. And yeah, we were searching for kind of felt artists, and she was just like by far the best. And she was an amazing person to work with. And she's actually got, sorry, I'm going on a bit here, but she's got this amazing, like the full size version is like 3 times the size of the cover. And you can see, actually, if you go onto our Instagram, the Little White Lies Instagram, you can see like she did a sort of like making of video of it. So you can see the kind of amount of time and labor that went into kind of creating all the little kind of individual pieces. So yeah, it's a fun one.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly is, and it's a very fun film. Lillian, do we have any appearances from you in the new issue?
Yes, I'm contributing to our space pod that we've sent off to the aliens in space. I have a little piece in there and a review as well.
Yeah, just to clarify, there's a big feature in there, which was one of my most fun features to organize, where we kind of came up, like, just in the spirit of the film Asteroid City, we came up with this idea of, well, if we were going to send a pod into space to teach alien races about the cinema of Wes Anderson, what would we put in it? And I just got this really amazing response from our kind of coterie of writers about all these individual bits and bobs that could be put in the pod. And for each thing, we kind of tried to make a physical object that would be in the pod. So for Lillian's contribution, we like knitted it, like one of my colleagues knitted a cigarette, which is fun.
Yeah.
We need more knitting in print publishing.
But yeah, I mean, there are some amazing interviews in there as well. I mean, Jason Schwartzman and Hannah Strong, what a pairing.
Yeah, that was amazing. She spoke to him in Cannes and on the phone, and I was sort of in the other room, and you could just, all I could hear was her sort of laughing at like sort of 2 minute intervals. Like, so yeah, it's a really, a really amazing, fun interview. Yeah, we got an interview with Wes and Maya Hawke and Robert Yeoman, who's his very, very long time cinematographer. So we've got all those guys in there. And yeah, if you're a Wes head, do go pick it up.
Well, I think probably listeners of this podcast and Wes heads as a Venn diagram is a circle. So
indeed.
But yeah, we should get a move on with probably a slightly less beloved film that is coming out this week. It's The Flash.
Join our community of film lovers by becoming a Little White Lies member. We receive exclusive perks and an insider's view into the world of Little White Lies while directly supporting our independent film journalism. Search Little White Lies membership via your search engine and click through to our Steady HQ page for a detailed breakdown of the plans. Now on to the movies.
Barry Allen, aka The Flash, travels back in time to prevent his mother's murder, which traps him in an alternate reality without metahumans. He enlists the help of his younger self, an older Batman, and a Kryptonian castaway Supergirl in order to save this world from the restored General Zod and return to his universe. So, Lillian, I came into this weary. I simply do not have another multiverse in me. Did you have any kind of glimmers of optimism when you were entering The Flash?
Well, not really. I suppose I haven't seen one of these for a little while, which is one of the nice things, is that you only actually have to watch these films when someone pays you to. So it's nice to have been able to take a bit of a backseat on some of the multiverse fare for a while. So I was going in thinking that it might be fine. Some of the early reviews had been quite positive. There's a poster which has a quote on it that says, "One of the best superhero films ever made," which is credited to a Twitter handle, which I rather enjoyed as a piece of marketing. So I thought that this might be a positive way to approach the film. But yes, I think one of the things I kept thinking about was that video of Hayao Miyazaki being shown CGI footage and saying that it's an insult to life itself. And that was really how this film just sort of ended up manifesting itself for me. I think there came a point where there was so much CG on screen that I couldn't really make out what was going on, and I just sort of had to close my eyes and put in my earplugs and wait for it to lie back and think of England in that situation. Yes, this was quite a distressing cinematic experience, I would say.
Yeah, I mean, I got to say, I was vaguely with it for the first hour. I found some of the sort of quippiness not as unbearable as it could have been. I thought Ezra was quite charming in parts. The ridiculous scene where he's saving a lot of babies that are kind of tumbling out of a collapsing building was quite fun. But it's, yes, it lost me. And I ended up in a similar place of despair.
The babies were quite fascinating to look at. I couldn't really work out if at any point the babies were real. And it's the real laziness of CGI that really got to me at that point in the film. Because as you say, it sort of starts off and you have about 5 minutes of calm before the absolute mania of what's going on. And those babies do look like they're completely rounded, and there's a lot of, everything's very smooth in this film. When Supergirl shows up, she doesn't really look real. She looks like a video game character. And I couldn't quite work out if it was a real person or not in the way that she's sort of been shot within the film. It reminded me a lot of the early CG in sort of the Matrix sequels, when it would start with some sort of real effects and some real live action fight choreography, and then suddenly everything would become CGI, and you couldn't quite work out if there was anything real on the screen. Which I suppose in something like, the way to get around that, of course, is to make a film like Spider-Verse, where you have everything animated, so it doesn't matter if it looks like this. Whereas here, it's very hard to distinguish between what is actually real and what isn't, and it ends up just looking like this strange sort of computer-generated soup that is very distressing and overwhelming to sit through.
David, did you find yourself overwhelmed and distressed as well?
You know, I will say that, like, I think that's an interesting point you make at the beginning about how we come to these films and the kind of the baggage and the stress and the fatigue that we come loaded with. And I think that if you're someone who is constantly kind of going back to the trough for these films, I can absolutely understand that, you know, that this would be a kind of tiring and tiresome thing. I don't think I've seen one of the Marvels that deals with a multiverse. I'm trying to cast my mind back, but like I didn't see like the Doctor Strange Multiverse of Madness, and I haven't seen the new Spider-Man either. So
two Spider-Man multiverses. There's the No Way Home one, and there's the
I didn't Spiders. See No Way Home indeed. So like this was a first kind of mainstream multiverse experience for me. But I had, this was on the back that my last two big studio juggernaut films were Shazam 2 and Transformers. So like I was very much like, it cannot be worse. And I think that might have been why I thought it was decent, but absolutely agree with everything you're saying about the visual sludge effect. I think with these weird kind of human effigy, like digital effigies that they have, I was watching the film sort of trying to think, because it's, as you say, it's so conspicuous. With CGI, they're trying to kind of hide, you know, the whole idea of it is like, it's got to fool the eye, you know, it's got to be to a level where you can suspend disbelief in a way that you're not thinking of like the process and the form. And in this film, you very much do. And I think is it trying to justify itself by saying this is what things look like when the Flash is running, is in the Speed Force or whatever it is that he's in. But like I've been so kind of hothoused in the world of like half-assed comic book digital special effects that I couldn't let it get me too hung up. But yeah, the film is essentially a kind of riff on sort of time travel movies and specifically Back to the Future 2. They make references to the fact that in this, Barry essentially goes back in time to save his mother from being murdered, like completely randomly and in a way that is never really explained. You know, so it's a kind of completely random, a guy walks into that to their lovely suburban home and knifes her for no reason affair. So Barry decides to go back, and having been kind of given a little brief tutorial on the butterfly effect by Batman, no less. He decides to go back and change one tiny little detail, and which will kind of like send the universe spiraling off in a different direction, and with the hope that his mother will be alive. And he is successful in that respect, but is unsuccessful in other respects. And it's a story of like, well, how does the real Barry get back to his own timeline, but in the same time try to come to terms with the fact that the death of his mother is a kind of inevitable part of reality, or at least his reality. You know, I found that kind of that sort of central idea, which is very like, you know, old as the hills kind of concept, was done quite well. And Ezra Miller, I think they actually are able to do the kind of slapstick comedy and the sort of deep pathos really nicely, like flipping from those extremes and actually really kind of selling it. And at the same time, I can absolutely understand why people might find their performance quite grating, and it's very, very extra. But yeah, the last thing I'll say is like, I'm trying to defend it a little bit, but like, and it might sound like I'm clutching at straws, but like, it does deal with this multiverse thing, and there is this kind of element to it where you have all these, like, the alternative realities are represented through like vintage comic book stories, and they come to life through the different actors who have played various comic book superheroes through time. And it was quite, I thought there was something, and maybe you can respond by saying that this is something that's been done to death already, but like, you know, I quite like the fact that sort of here's a film that you know, suggesting that time is now relative to who played who in a superhero movie. You know, like our memories are kind of are imprinted, and you know, the kind of yardstick of when things happen and events on our the sort of banal events of our life can be kind of connected to, oh well, that was the George Clooney Batman era, or that was the Christopher Reeve Superman era. And like, there was something quite sort of interesting about that idea. I don't know how far it was kind of, you know, it was really sort of pushing it, like it was, you know, actually pushing that idea, or I'm just sort of reading something deeper into it. But you know, I guess that idea of a multiverse was quite interesting to me.
See, I interpreted those sort of callbacks as just, here is all of the IP that we have access to, and it's very superficial in the way it's presented. It doesn't add anything to a sense of narrative, and I think that if we're combining all of these elements and trying to cram them all together, there's just absolutely, there's no stakes involved. And I think that's been a real issue of the multiverse in general. What I will say to your point about the plot and the sort of this narrative about his mother is that did add a certain stake to it that I think has lacked in a lot of other multiverse films, where you just think, well, if there's an alternate universe where everything is possible that has happened, then the one that's happening in this one doesn't actually sort of matter at all. Whereas in this case, because those universes had converged on this very specific sort of domestic narrative, I found that quite enjoyable. And Mirabel Verdú plays Barry Allen's mother, which is quite a strange casting choice. I didn't expect to see her in one of these films, and I think that she gives quite a tender performance. This is actually my favourite scene in the film, is when a young Barry and she are sort of preparing dinner together, and he's doing his homework, and he can't understand how there are so many different ways to create equations to add up to 24, which seemed to me to be suggesting, and I think a lot of the characterisation of Barry Allen and The Flash is about neurodivergence, and specifically about ADHD, and how he is sort of using that as a form of superpower, which is often talked about in relation to neurodivergence. What I found really quite strange was the fact that those symptoms, or those signs, that those characteristics, those behaviours, are not evident in the alternate Barry Allen. So when we have the two Barry Allens, it's almost like Ezra Miller is sort of playing one of them as neurodivergent and the other one as neurotypical, and I found that very, very odd. And I wasn't quite sure if it was suggestive of the fact that the powers had given him this sort of form of character, or what Ezra Miller's idea of characterizing this character in that way was. I suppose if I'm trying to find something that I was actually sort of intellectually engaging with in this film, it was probably that, rather than what I said about the point at which it just sort of devolves into absolute nothingness. And as Layla said, the first sort of hour does have these ideas which are interesting to think about.
Well, I mean, I agree with you as well. I mean, one of the things that appealed to me about this film, and I think that did make it feel a bit different from so many other of the have superhero offerings, especially like, you know, just you know, just because it's on my mind, Shazam 2, which was just the, you know, for me, the absolute pits. It wasn't just like, here's the character. Oh, there's a new supervillain in the house that they're threatening to do something awful, and we've got to stop them. This was actually kind of like, there is no bad guy. There is that, you know, this is about kind of fixing a problem. This is about saving someone, saving yourself. And actually, you know, like that was the thing that kept me engaged. Like there are antagonists and there are sort of people doing bad things, but they are not the kind of we need to do X to achieve Y. And I felt the film was addressing this idea of like, maybe we can't just keep doing that over and over again. You know, like there's actually a kind of motif in the film near the end where it's almost asking the question, can we keep doing this rote, we've got to kill a bad guy thing? Again, maybe I'm reading too deeply into this, but it sounds like I'm kind of defending the film here. And I am a bit, because I think I thought there was stuff that was really enjoyable about it. Like another thing that I liked, and you know, results may vary, I guess, but like the Michael Keaton returns in as Batman, as his kind of, you know, the Tim Burton era Batman. And he brings gravitas and humor to a role that I just don't remember seeing for a long time, even when he's having to like spout little kind of like callback quotations out of context that just you know, there are bits of like fan service, quote unquote, that just fall completely flat. But for the first couple of like the half of his sort of section that he's in, I thought, you know, he's really good. That there's a kind of heist bit that he's involved in, and it's like just the stunts and the way he, you know, that was the thing that gave me the real kind of tingles of nostalgia of like, just, you know, let's just have some simple fight choreography and, you know, some cool quite sort of old school gadgets, and, you know, like it just that stuff just, yeah, that worked really well for me.
I guess the issue for me is those sorts of things just make me remember a better time. Kind of, it's almost like, here's the thing that you once had. Let us remind you of it constantly, and then let us show you the sludgy mess that we created in its place.
Yeah, it's like those moments of when you have Michael Keaton, they're just suddenly then degenerate into this smooth, slick movement that it looks absolutely nothing like what Tim Burton was creating in those first two Batman films. And the use of music's really weird in this film, because Benjamin Wolfish does the score, who works with Andy Muschietti quite a lot. He did like the music for the It films, and he seems to just have complete free reign to use like Danny Elfman's music for Batman and John Williams' music for Superman. And
wasn't that I thought that was Danny Elfman's music.
It was Danny Elfman's music, so he's able to use it. It's just the idea that these things aren't, I don't want to use, say, I suppose it is sacred, isn't it, to those original, it all just turns those films into just another piece of content that is owned within this universe, and they can be used in whatever way. And even, I mean, I don't want to, I know that people are very precious about these films being spoiled, but there's even IP that doesn't really exist or would have existed in our own alternate universe. And I find that absolutely baffling and quite disturbing to see that there is no, we have no possession over ourselves anymore, and that everything is up for grabs to be used in whatever way these films want to use them, which I just didn't think had any sincerity to it.
Yes, not to spoil, but one in particular should do. Yep. I found absolutely grotesque, absolutely grotesque. But yes, we should get some scores on this before kind of I descend into my rant about the abomination that happens in the final act. David, you want to go first?
Sure. You know, I would say that I was probably not, you know, I think that this film had some bad juju before going in. You know, there were lots of like red flags to do with various things, and you know, maybe it was a 2 going in. I mean, I'm always very skeptical of when, you know, a film has been shown at like CinemaCon or something and gets like rave reviews. You know, that for me is like the ultimate red flag. But actually, I ended up, yeah, having a decent time with it. And like, I know a lot of people like, you know, just to add, you know, Hannah's done a great review on littlewhitelies.com that kind of really goes quite deep into the film, and its various sort of like sources, and goes really deep into the context of it and where it's kind of coming from. And it's and that was really enjoyable and educational to read for me. So, but yeah, it's probably a threes in enjoyment in retrospect. Like, I definitely was a kind of those kind of movies, it was a more pleasant experience. I laughed a few times in this film.
Yes, I mean, I must say, now that you've mentioned Shazam 2 and that memory's come flooding back, I do think it's slightly warm to this this pile of vomit for me, I suppose. Lillian, what about you? What are your scores?
I was spared the pleasure of Shazam 2, but I would give it the benefit of the doubt. I try never to go into a film thinking it's going to be the absolute worst film of all time. So we'll stick the anticipation at a two. But it is the worst film of all time, I think, perhaps, or at least it is in my current understanding of it. I don't think I've ever quite had to try to go into a state of zen that I did during this film, sort of closing my eyes and shutting myself out from what was going on. It made me question my mortality and how much longer I can sit through these kinds of films. I felt every minute of those 155. And yeah, it was an arduous and painful experience. So enjoyment and in retrospect, both at a one for me.
Yeah, I think I'm at about a 2-1. What enjoyments I did take from it was taken away by the fact that I felt that it was a violation of a lot of people's legacies, I suppose. And I think there's a very worrying trend happening here when it comes to the ability of these deep fakes and things to happen. And I think people should be outraged, and we should figure out a system which what is okay to do and what isn't, because there's been some really disturbing usage of it of late. But next up, we should move on to a much smaller film, Pretty Red Dress. Pretty Red Dress follows a South London family and how one red dress is at the centre of their lives. But before we get into the film itself, I spoke to director Dionne Edwards about her debut and its exploration of gender and family.
Yeah, I was so desperate to see it because I missed it at the BFI Fest, the London Film Festival. And then it's like, what was that slightly annoying thing of having to wait till it actually for the next round to get a peek?
Yeah, but it's ages. It's like June. Yeah, that's months and months and months, isn't it?
But I mean, it must be kind of nice coming to it with, you know, having had people see it, having gotten that affirmation, it's great, people really liked it, and now, you know, that pressure is off with the cinema release, I guess.
Well, I don't know if the pressure's off, because I always think, well, maybe some people liked it then, and then when we get, you know, months later, they might not like it again. So there was a bit of anxiety, but so far, so good. We've had some reviews come in. They've been really positive so far. So yeah, I can't complain.
Oh, and it is kind of a bit of a challenging thing, I suppose, because there's not a lot of films out there like this, kind of tonally, I suppose, because it's not kind of misery, kind of trauma, but it's not sort of like unrelentingly grim, and it's not like kind of feel good British movie either. Like, how would you describe the tone?
Well, it's really interesting because I was just having another interview, and I find in interviews, like, some people talk about the originality and say, you know, it's, there's been some discussion about, like, is this original because of some of the topics discussed? And then on the other hand, certain interviewers sort of say it's really original. So I find that really interesting in where it sits. And also, I've been hearing a lot that there's warmth in it, and I always like intended for it to be this sort of mix of grit and glamour are the two words that we used. But yeah, I thought it'd be interesting to kind of explore masculinity and femininity and hardness and softness. But what I found is in terms of reactions, like, a lot of people come out there saying it's really warm, it's really joyful. And that's really interesting because I think there's some dark things in there and some difficult things in there. But primarily I've been getting that it's warm and joyful, which I think is actually a really good thing. It means that people are sort of coming out of the cinema or the screening or wherever they've watched it a bit lifted. So yeah, I think it's really good, and I think it's really interesting.
I mean, then there's certainly some dark moments kind of in towards the, I won't give any spoilers, but towards the third act, it did all feel like they are just like rushing headlong into tragedy. But I guess you do provide a bit of relief from that. So it's not sort of what you're left with.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think music always helps that as well. And especially if you're going to put in some of these great tracks that we've got, these Tina Turner, like, sort of 60s, 70s tracks, they really give it a lift as well. So that's helpful.
I mean, with her recent passing, I think people are reflecting so much more on what she symbolized. And I guess you, in this film, she's got that great masculinity and femininity combined, like these characters do.
Yeah, for sure. Like she, it's weird. The journey of sort of how the dress came to be and how Tina Turner came into it, I can't actually pinpoint like what exactly that was and when it happened. And I almost don't want to go back. I want to just kind of think of it in a dreamlike state. But somehow I think as the Candice character, because I started with Travis and then I started developing Candice, I was thinking about the things that she was into, and Tina Turner came to it. And yeah, whether it was the red dress first or Tina Turner, I don't know, but I guess Tina Turner she was just absolutely at the forefront of like innovation when it came to like stage performance and taking, you know, as a woman, you know, around the time when you had people like Diana Ross and the Supremes, who were much more sort of elegant and, you know, brilliant in themselves, but sort of everything was a little bit more, you know, restrained. And Tina Turner would get on stage and it would be like she'd have these like beautiful dresses on with sequins, but they were really short, which kind of gave you a look into like her sexuality and everything. And then she'd just like sort of gyrate and screw up her face, and it was as if, you know, she was influenced by Preachers and like James Brown and people like that. So it was really interesting because, you know, she was kind of celebrating her femininity but also expressing some masculinity, and I thought that was really interesting. But also because her journey as an artist, but her journey as a person as well, with the difficult things that she had to go through and what she had to overcome, and how she used going on stage to kind of have a release. I don't know, that all kind of subconsciously tied in to this film and the red dress. And yeah, I mean, we wouldn't have a film without Tina Turner. So yeah, it's very sad, but also like I thank her for this legacy that she's left.
Oh yeah, I mean, what a woman. But it were kind of, there is a sort of 70-ish, I mean, I kind of thought maybe 70s feel to it, both in the sort of era of Tina that you've gone for, but also in the aesthetic of the film. Were those your kind of influences?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Yeah. I really love the 70s period and sort of late 60s period of American cinema in particular. Saturday Night Fever was a huge influence, which is kind of a strange one because people obviously remember John Travolta and Flares. But also, like, I think that film just demonstrates kind of grit and glamour really well. And I really love the way it sort of is set in this like kind of gritty neighborhood in Brooklyn. And, you know, you get a sense of this realism, but also these really beautiful heightened moments with the dance scenes. And there's something just so cinematic about it. And then I was also influenced by the British film Babylon as well. You know, the 79. Franco Rossi, yeah. And just Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore, Scorsese. And that's just generally like a lot of my taste. But I just love the way there's kind of imperfection in a lot of 70s cinema. I mean, since then we've grown very sort of glossy and very technical and everything is very smooth. And I really enjoy sometimes you watch these films and they're a bit, you know, rugged and imperfect in sort of the camera movement and everything. And they do this amazing thing of like taking brilliant actors who, you know, just go straight into their characters really deeply and you believe that's them. And they mix that with cinematic techniques, but also, yeah, the key word imperfect, they're not perfect either. I really love that. So I think that's definitely had a lot of influence on the film.
I mean, and how do you get an actor like Nathie Jones, who's like, because it's an exploration of gender, it's an exploration of Black masculinity, but one that is not easily labelled, and he has to have this sort of such a range to him. I mean, what were you looking for and how did you find it?
Mm. Well, that's exactly what we were looking for, range. We really needed an actor who had a lot of range, and we needed someone who could play the tough guy from the neighborhood, from ends, who could do that really well, then who could also put a dress on and have that softness, that flow, that ease. And we found often with actors, it was like one or the other. And then when we were getting somewhere with some actors, a lot of them were very uneasy about the role, obviously, because the themes explored. And I think we're not really, I always think to myself, what would it be like if this was a role for a white actor, and how many, you know, would we have had the same struggles with the auditions? But yeah, it was tough, and we got very close to the shoot and we're getting really scared. And then Natie did a tape and it was amazing. And then we kept seeing him. And I think what I saw in him was this just deep sensitivity and this mysteriousness in a way. And then just intelligence. And then, yeah, he just really took the character and lifted him off the page. And I think that's because Nate is like, he's got a background in theatre, which is amazing. So he has the ability, and, you know, he does musical theatre as well. So he's like a dancer, he's a singer, he's an actor. So he has this very like amazing physical ability, but also he can be really restrained. And a lot of the character, the way he plays a lot of the characters is sort of very pulled back and it's all on his face. So it was really exciting when we found Nate because he was able to do everything, to be really sort of instinctive, but also very technical as an actor. So it felt like destiny in a way. And I couldn't imagine anyone else playing him.
Yeah, and I was so impressed by Alexandra Burke as well, because like knowing her from TV is having such a big personality and so sparkly and so kind of, you know, delightful, but like quite over the top. And in this, she's like quite, she's very subtle. Like she's got like a lot of very nuanced moments. She doesn't ham it up at all.
Yeah. Well, Alexandra, I mean, I think in most actors, you want to sort of, I like to, especially in actors that maybe aren't huge stars. I mean, Alex is a huge star in music, but not necessarily known for her film and TV roles. This was her first role in film. And yeah, she has these amazing qualities. She's very sort of, she's got a larger than life personality. But I think what I loved, what I took from her is she has a lot of warmth as well. And incredible energy. And it's funny because like when I was first having conversations with her, she said like the character could have almost been her and the life she could have had, where if she didn't sort of win X Factor, that could have been something quite different. And she was just talking about how much she related to the character. And there was something in that that I really liked. She's very fearless and she's unafraid to look silly. She just goes for it every single time. And I think she really takes direction so well. It was an absolute like pleasure to direct her. It was a lot of fun. And she just went for it all the time.
And I mean, it feels like quite a brave script in many senses, because you're also kind of challenging some kind of taboos, like the resentment that you might have towards your child and the sort of like, you know, being a Black woman who's not necessarily magnanimous all times and selfless, you know, these are sadly things that we don't see a lot of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought that was interesting when you said taboo, that described that as taboo, if we're going to talk about the cross-dressing side. But yeah, that is really interesting. And it's funny because when, you know, there's a scene in the film, I don't know if I want to give too much away, but she says something, you know, she says an insult. Mm-hmm. And the audience always gasps and they're like, oh my gosh. And there was a lot of worry at script stage if we were going to lose the audience there. But I think that she's such a great character and so layered that you kind of understand her reasoning, even though it wasn't necessarily the best thing. So yeah, it's really interesting that you caught on to that.
Yeah, it's that 1970s return where you actually have like people that aren't just good guys and bad guys, and people contain multitudes.
Yeah.
And then filling out this trio, you have this young actress who's never performed in anything before, who is, you know, meets them at their level of the other two. Established. How did you find her?
So Temi Lola Olatunbosun, she was, so our casting director had seen her for other things. They do a lot of street casting and they recommended her and she came in. And for the Kanisha character, we were trying to do sort of a more workshopping style of auditioning for kids. So I usually find that's the best way. So getting them to do different improvs and stuff. And she just came in and straight away, since she opened her mouth, we were like, oh my gosh, there she is, there's a character. She didn't even know what she was auditioning for. And Georgia, the producer, always jokes, like when she was on her third audition, she said, what is this? What am I auditioning for? She almost had the part. And then she just said, what is this? And we're like, you know, you're auditioning for a feature film for BBC and BFI. And she was like, oh, okay. And we're like, what did you think you were doing there? But yeah, she just has this very sort of uncanny ability to act natural with a camera. And, you know, it's really difficult for anyone with a camera on them to act natural. But for a kid for the first time, I don't know how she does it. She just really just, as soon as you know, she's quite shy in real life, but as soon as you've got a camera on her, it's like she just falls into the character. She was just really able to bring out that character. I think she is quite different in real life, but there was something deep that she understood. And yeah, she just wasn't intimidated at all by Nate or Alexandra. She just was straight in there. So amazing.
God, I wish I was that cool when I was 14.
I know, it's ridiculous.
Oh, well, thank you so much for your time. And best
thank you.
Great
questions. And I'm really happy that you like picked up on certain things as well, because sometimes people don't pick up on these things.
Well, I try. Thank you. Bye. So,
Speak soon.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
So, David, you've done the review for Little White Lies. I was pretty charmed by this. How did you feel about it?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really impressive, bold film. And, you know, I think, like, I think there are some elements of it that are a little rough around the edges, which is kind of understandable for kind of, is it, it's a debut? Yeah.
I believe it was a short, and then she's, you know, made the feature.
Right. You know, which are to be expected, but, like, you know, so much potential there. Yeah, I guess it's dealing with an issue that, you know, I don't think we necessarily see dealt with a lot in this way and with this kind of tone and with this and this sense of, like, dramatic seriousness as well. That's not to say it's a completely serious film. There is a kind of playful and quite cinematic element to it. You have this character, Travis, played by Natey Jones, who is introduced coming out of prison, and he comes home to his wife Candice, played by Alexandra Burke, who is of, you know, is it Britain's Got Talent, or
I think she was X Factor.
sorry. She's a kind of talent show grandee who has kind of gone on to other things, and proves here that she's actually a really good actor as well. And then you have their daughter as well, Kanisha, who is kind of questioning at school, privately questioning her sexuality, but is apprehensive about, you know, coming out and talking and letting her friends know and letting her parents know. But it turns out that, you know, this isn't a film about kind of teen sexuality. It's also a film about adult, you know, adult sexuality, and essentially having an experience which makes you question, you know, just question your own mind about these things. And the film kind of plays out as this, you know, it's like a kind of, like, slightly comic musical drama in which we see this character who is, he's working nights, so he's left to sort of, like, flop about in their flat in the day, and meanwhile Candice is in the process of auditioning for a role in a Tina Turner R.I.P. musical, and they buy this sort of the red dress of the title, which is this kind of sequined, very, very revealing kind of vintage dress. And, you know, Natey obviously, you know, is it holds some kind of great appeal for him, and you think, oh, he wants to see Candice in it, but actually it turns out that he wants to wear it himself, and, you know, he takes pleasure from wearing the dress. Yeah, the film kind of plays out this sort of variation of this secret that he has, and the sort of private pleasures that gradually become public. And I think the way that it's dealt with is, it deals with this kind of, like, maybe what you'd call a social taboo in a way that is very kind of mature and interesting. And there are some big kind of dramatic heated moments. I think some elements of it didn't work for me. It maybe felt a little hysterical at times in the way that people reacted. And sometimes I thought that Edward's direction was a little bit overwrought. Like, sometimes I felt that she maybe didn't have the full trust of her actors to just point the camera at them and let them do the work. And I think that there was maybe too often a feeling that she felt that she needed to like have a camera moving or create some sort of like maybe slightly false dynamism to lift the material, when actually everything is there. And what you want in a film like this is to just delve into the actors and have the most kind of direct contact with them possible. And I think there's just a few little things she does throughout the film that maybe creates a bit of undue distance, so you're not quite getting as deep under the skin as you maybe could. But in the main, yeah, a very, very impressive film.
Lillian, for you, I mean, it's not a subtle film, should we say? But was it?
No, it's not. And I think that David's point about what Dionne Edwards is doing in terms of stylization often detracts from the subtleties of what is actually there within the film, and that I found very compelling and often quite moving. As you said, Layla, that it was based on a short film, which I confess I haven't seen. I'd quite like to see that, because this film is very long. It's 150 minutes, and I don't think that is at all justified. And it almost feels like someone is trying to take a sort of chamber piece or a chamber story almost and turn it into something cinematic. So it has a lot going on within it. I actually think that this is a very successful film about someone who wants to play Tina Turner in a West End show. I think it's a really lovely performance from Alexandra Burke, someone who I had sort of noticed was doing the pantomime circuit for a few years, so it's nice to see her doing something a bit more adult, a bit more grown up, which this performance very much is. And I think that she has an amazing voice for doing Tina Turner. And there's one sort of flight of fantasy, which is a sequence of singing Proud Mary, which I thought was absolutely the strongest moment in this film. I really, really loved that. And I found the dynamic between her character Candice and her daughter Kanisha, who's played by Temalola Alatan-Boson, who's absolutely wonderful in this film. I think that she's, the way that she interacts with her parents is really interesting, particularly in terms of how she's sort of dealing with her own sexuality, how that's manifesting in her behaviour at school, and how her two different parents are sort of responding to that. In terms of Travis's characterisation, which I suppose is really how this film is centering itself. So you have these three quite different, it's like a triptych of storylines, and they're all quite different. And the way that Travis is portrayed is, I just didn't really understand what it was trying to commit to showing with him. I liked the fact that we were seeing a different form of sexual partnership between himself and his partner, which I don't think I've seen very often. I think that the sort of power play within their relationship was really interesting, particularly in terms of how Travis is interacting in the sex scenes within the film, which I thought were really beautifully handled. I just never really got an impression of what this dress actually sort of was doing for him, or what it meant for him, and what these clothes were doing for him. Not that I think that it needs to label itself, and I quite like the fact that there's a fluidity of this, and there's not really an idea of it. I just never really got the impression that Natey Jones in his acting was actually ever compelled by this dress or a desire to wear it. He actually sort of, he looks very uncomfortable wearing it, and I couldn't work out if it was a sort of, if it was a sexual thing, if it was a form of cross-dressing that he was interested in. And these questions are asked throughout the film, and he's never really sort of able to articulate what's going on. I found that aspect quite frustrating, even though actually in some ways it's also liberating. So it's this strange kind of dynamic. I think that people will watch this film and have to try to work that out for themselves. And what I think is good is that a lot of gender and trans related issues within the landscape of Britain are so often labelled and put into very distinct categories, and this film sort of refuses to do any of that. But at the same time, by sort of avoiding them entirely, it lacks a certain focus that I wasn't entirely clear on.
There is almost like one of the interesting things that I, again, it was a hard thing to sort of know whether it was a good or a bad thing, but like this idea of Natey is this really actually chaotic character who just makes loads and loads of like, but not just bad decisions, just like, you know, really silly decisions. And there's this kind of almost a kind of comic motif where he It's the classic thing of, you know, he'll be at home alone, you know, he's checked no one in the house, he puts the red dress on, and then suddenly someone comes home and he's like scrambling to get it off and get it back into the wardrobe. And that happens like two or three times where he just can't, you know, he just can't get this break, he can't get this peace and to be able to sort of like do the thing that he wants to do alone. And You know that kind of stuff. I found it sometimes hard to judge whether that was like, is it kind of like just riffing on this cliche over and over again, or is it sort of making some comment on like, you know, he's not someone who is completely in tune with his ideas and what he's thinking and his emotions and feelings and things.
I read it as deliberate. I think that there's a sort of semi-conscious or unconscious desire to get caught, to get to show this, and that's actually a part of it. And I quite liked that. I quite like that it's sort of showing this almost... The shame that comes around it for him is manifested in increasingly sort of disturbing ways. I mean, towards the end, there's a scene which is difficult to watch, I would say, because it's almost like watching someone having a breakdown on the screen. But I'm not really sure what catharsis there was for that. And it's one of these strange films which sort of stages itself almost as like a British feel-good film. And it has this sort of Tina Turner dynamic. And then it doesn't really know where to go with that. So I found that I found those tonal shifts in that respect quite... I feel like this film was trying to be just a nice film, but it didn't really know how to get the landing right. And as a result, it goes on for 150 minutes rather than cutting off at about the 90-minute point.
Yes, this is not a week of discipline in the editing room, I suppose. But David, you want to get some scores on this?
Yeah, you know, I'm probably going to give it threes across the board. You know, I think it's, you know, really, really strong debut. I think Dionne Edwards is a really interesting new voice. And, you know, I hope that she is already in production with another movie, that she's exploring, you know, similar kind of themes or dealing with intricate themes in such a way. So I'm giving it a thumbs up.
Lillian, what about you?
Anticipation would probably be a four. I thought that it looked like quite a radical and different take, particularly on Black masculinity, Black British masculinity, which I don't think is something that I've seen explored in this way ever before. So my enjoyment in retrospect would probably be about a three. I think it dealt with it in very interesting ways. I just think that I was hoping for something a bit more substantial and stronger, but more Alexandra Burke in dramas, please. That was a nice surprise.
Yes, because I mean, David, you won't know as you didn't watch The X-Factor, evidently, but like she's a big character. She's a, like kind of an almost an Alison Hammond level, like a real ham. So actually, this kind of subtlety of performance is pretty extraordinary. Yeah, I think I'm kind of in the same zone of like I can't quite give it fours, very very high threes, but it's a very promising debut, and I think it's, you know, I'd be very interested to see what everybody involved does next. And some of it really did stick with me. I mean, there's a scene involving the police that I found utterly harrowing. And you don't want to damn it too much with faint praise by saying just like, oh, you know, good test for what happens next. But I mean, I imagine this isn't going to be her finest film that she ever makes, but certainly one that I would recommend people pop out to the cinemas to see. Next up, what has been referred to as one of the worst films of all time. It's Glen or Glenda. Glenn doesn't tell his fiancée Barbara that he likes to wear women's clothes. In addition, Alan is undergoing painful surgery to become a woman. Both stories are told by a psychiatrist. So, Lillian, I mean, I certainly don't think this is one of the worst films of all time. I don't think it's
I wonder if the person who called this the worst film of all time is the same person who said Flash was the best superhero film.
Yeah. No, this is definitely not the worst film this week, in my view.
It's the best. But, I
mean, it is certainly the best film we've got. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it is a trip, this movie, but I mean, I was watching it for the first time. I had seen Edward, the
Tim Burton.
Important.
Yeah. Who's it by?
Tim Burton.
Oh, yes. I had seen Edward, the Tim Burton film, so I was kind of slightly familiar with it. I didn't really know what to expect. Had you come to this before this week?
Yes. Well, it's an interesting one. I've certainly engaged with this film a lot. I'm very interested in Edward, and I have been for a long time. And I think that he's someone who still is deeply misunderstood in film. And I think that it's interesting because I think most people will know about Edward through the Tim Burton film. So I think it's a good starting point to talk about this film and the way it's presented. And the issue I've always had with Edward as a film is that I can never be certain how it's playing Edward's life and his situation, particularly in its approach to his transvestitism and the fact that he likes to wear women's clothing, and Bela Lugosi's career, which we'll come to in a minute, and whether or not it's playing these things as empathy and to garner empathy for these characters, or if it's playing it for laughs and that we're supposed to be laughing at and mocking Johnny Depp wearing a dress. So I think that it's an interesting starting point, and it's the first film that Edward makes. He's aware of the fact that this huge news story, I mean, it can't really be understated how big it is, in 1952, that Christian Jorgensen comes back from Denmark, having had what is referred to as a sex change, but what we would now call gender confirmation surgery, or casually known as bottom surgery, that she's undergone. And Edward is fascinated by this because Edward is someone who has been wearing women's clothing since he was a child, and he starts wondering about his own gender identity and whether or not this is a form of surgery that he would want to have. And he knows other people within his sort of social circle, within his filmmaking circle, particularly someone called Bunny Breckenridge, who later inspires Gore Vidal's book, Myra Breckenridge, who does want to have this surgery. They never actually had that surgery because for various reasons, but they tried repeated times. So it's something that Edward is sort of existing within the world of, but it's very much something that's not talked about until now, and it's become this huge thing when he comes to make this film in 1953. Of course, Edward doesn't have great studio backing and needs to get the money from an exploitation company called Screen Classics and a producer called George Weiss, who backs it as this sort of sex change exploitation B-movie picture that's going to play in small, crummy theatres in the US. And he basically wants something that people can be shocked by, be disgusted by, and laugh at. And Edward wants to make a very sympathetic documentary about these people, about his own identity and about his friends' identities. So what we end up with is this very strange sort of hodgepodge of all of those ideas. And you have things that Weiss is adding in to flesh the film out, like these weird erotic vignettes where we see sort of master-slave sexual dynamics and whipping just sort of randomly inserted. And Edward's become friends with Bela Lugosi, who famously played Dracula in the 1930s version, and he has found him in Hollywood and asks him to do this narration, and there's lots of lightning flashes, and the way it all comes together actually is why it's been called the worst film of all time. But when we look at films like Rocky Horror Picture Show or later cult classics or something like Hedwig and the Angry Inch, which are all sort of have this transness to them, that actually this aesthetic works in its favour and is perhaps why it's now being reevaluated in the way that it has been.
Yeah, I mean, I really, really liked it, but I must say I did feel out of my mind watching it as well.
Well, it's a man who is out of his mind, and I think that's what I find it very moving. I find it very upsetting because this is someone who is clawing for a sense of self-understanding and an understanding of what all of these things are that aren't being talked about, that you can't talk about seriously, that aren't really understood academically or medically at this point. And it's almost like a cry, a really desperate cry for help and for love and understanding and empathy, pulling from all of these different fragments. So yeah, it's both remarkable but also very upsetting, I think. But it's still pretty incredible for in 1953 that this is an object that exists.
David, you still going to go with this was the best film of the week?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this was actually my the only other Edward film I've encountered is Plan 9 from Outer Space, and that was via this American show called Mystery Science Theater 3000, which is a kind of, I don't think it ever played on UK TV. I think it's on Netflix. Netflix actually at the moment, but it was like a cult show in the kind of 80s and 90s where they had these robots who would, it was a kind of proto form of like commentary where they do these kind of snarky commentaries over bad films. And I'm sure they did a bunch of Ed Wood. But yeah, no, like actually kind of encountering this one now, Glenn or Glenda, about a fortnight ago rewatched most of like Kenneth Anger's films, who we now, you know, who is now kind of considered a kind of godfather of like modern experimental film and queer representation, and you know, these ideas of kind of magic and stuff like that. But yeah, I mean, this Glenn or Glenda for me plays in that register where it's kind of dealing with, there is a kind of inherent campiness to it that comes from its kind of, you know, bargain basement production values, where you've got things like, yeah, as you say, these kind of random inserts. You've got Bela Lugosi's narration, which doesn't seem to like connect to anything that's happening on elsewhere in the film. You've got the kind of use of stock footage that's done in this very kind of charmingly haphazard way, but actually now like almost seems like you're watching a Jean-Luc Godard film, because it's that kind of, you know, there is a sort of abrasiveness to everything that just makes it feel like so exciting. Like, you know, you're watching these films, like, you know, you're watching it thinking this could go anywhere. This is where is it going to go next? What's the next scene going to bring? I think, you know, it's understandable why people might see this or might have seen this and like laughed at it or mocked it for whatever reason. But actually, like, I found the film like extremely moving, and it's the old cliche is like, you know, it really is so far ahead of its time in terms of maybe not in terms of like the sort of formal elements of it, but actually the subject matter, what it's talking about, the way it's talking about it, a lot of it, you know, even though it is very much from a different era, the sort of raw empathy there. And this idea of kind of, you know, people needing to sort of strive for kindness and understanding in these matters, and letting people, you know, exist in the way that they want to exist. It's a kind of beautiful message, and that really kind of comes through despite, you know, maybe sort of efforts to sort of conceal it or package it in a slightly different way. You know, Ed Wood's performance in the film as Glenn and Glenda, you know, it's coming from a place of like, you know, of kind of innocence and experience. You know, it's like, you know, it's quite, it's a fascinating lived in performance, but also it's interesting in the film that he's obviously trying to be someone else. He's trying to sort of present himself, his character, as this authority. But yeah, I mean, I only the version I watched was on Amazon, and you know, I was trying to sort of look at, you know, is this the right version? Is this the longest version? I think the version I watched ran at like 57 minutes or something. And I think there are kind of, I imagine there are numerous other cuts and lengths to the film with extra scenes, or it's the sort of film that you imagine has been like butchered over the years and probably, you know, slumbered in the public domain or whatever. But one of the things that I really like, last point, one of the things I really love about the current kind of DVD and Blu-ray home entertainment culture is that it's giving a real, these kind of auteurs, these kind of, you know, these kind of like grot auteurs who have been dismissed from the sort of 50s, 60s, who made kind of schlocky genre films, zero budget things. They just give you an amazing opportunity to just see the kind of, you know, to sort of wow in the sort of artfulness of what they were doing. And the, you know, there is a kind of, you know, there's a sort of punk, there's a punkishness to Ed Wood, which I just love, you know. And you know, I've only seen two of his movies, and I'm going to sort of delve a little deeper, I think.
No, it's worth doing so. I mean, this is the others are all very different to this one. This sort of stands out on its own. What I will say is a sort of in terms of how it's presenting this sort of documentary idea of what I think is very important in sort of queer history and queer legacies is that, of course, that there is heritage and there is precedent, and that the for a lot of people thinking, like watching something like Pretty Red Dress, for example, where I was saying that, you know, everyone wants to sort of categorize things and label things. And this film is sort of saying, well, you can't put everyone in the same box in this way, because you have these two stories. You have the sort of Glenn or Glenda narrative, and then you have the Alan or Anne narrative later on, which actually features some really quite extraordinary footage of surgery, which is historic in itself, as you say, it's sort of there's these uses of stock footage. And I think it's really interesting to look at it that way. A really great film that came out fairly recently, I think it's on BBC iPlayer, because I think it was released through Storyville, called Casa Susanna by Sebastian Lifshitz, who's done a few very interesting sort of trans-narrative documentaries, one called Little Girl, when was that, a couple of years ago now, which I thought was a really, really beautiful film. But Casa Susanna is fantastic and looks at the sort of history of a community of people who would go to this house and sort of just be able to exist around each other and dress however they want and be gendered however they want. And I think that it's interesting that that's really what Ed Wood is sort of coming out of. And to come back to the Tim Burton film again, there's a scene when Ed Wood asks Bunny Breckenridge, who's played by Bill Murray in the film, to gather these people together. And I was watching it again yesterday, and I was thinking, am I supposed being asked to laugh at this group of people, or am I being invited to empathize with them? And I think that that's really the shift that we continue to see played out is that idea. There's a moment in Ed Wood when the narrator says, you're doing it right. It's like, this is how people respond. You're doing it right now. You're laughing, aren't you? And most people watching this film, anyone with any empathy, would absolutely not be laughing at what they're seeing on screen. And I think that's the shift that we're continuing to see in relation to how we see trans people depicted on screen.
Yeah, what a lovely note to end on. I mean, it's certainly like, I mean, I found myself quite nervous going in, but yes, like you, that sort of radical empathy that it comes with was really quite moving. But we should wrap up with our final thing. You're going to give us some non-movie recommendations. Lillian, do you want to go first? What would you suggest people check out if they're not going to be in the cinema?
Yeah, well, I'm cheating slightly because it is sort of film related, I suppose, but I finally went to see the new Isaac Julian retrospective at the Tate Britain the other day, which has a series of Julian's video installations, include one called Looking for Langston, which is about the Harlem Renaissance and Langston Hughes and sort of black queerness and histories of black queerness within that film. But they've been set up on these incredible multi-screen installations within the Tate Britain, and I highly recommend going to see that if you're able to go.
I will find time, so I will be able to go.
That sounds amazing. Yeah, Looking for Langston's amazing.
Yeah, such a great film.
And David, what about you? What non-movie thing should people be looking out for?
I know that I always do this, but I'm going to sort of like, again, air my kind of gaming, my secret shame. I have been, like so many others, immersed in the world of Zelda Tears of the Kingdom on the Nintendo Switch. And it's a kind of brilliant and infuriating epic. It's this kind of huge open world game. And it's about 10 really good games, fully realized games that have been smushed together in a single game. And there's like, you're kind of playing it and you're thinking, I could probably be playing this forever. Sometimes you think, I don't necessarily want to be playing this forever, and I want to be able to see a light at the end of the tunnel. But that it's certainly it sapped a lot of my time up, and not in an unenjoyable way. I don't think I'm one of these people who see it as the kind of, you know, one of the greatest games of all time, but it's certainly an impressive feat, and I'm, you know, getting some enjoyment out of playing it.
It does feel like a kind of semi-recommendation and a little bit like heed my warning.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty much the only thing I can recommend non-film, apart from doing nail polish with my daughter, which I don't think counts. That's the only kind of non-film thing I've been engaging with recently.
Fair enough. So if you've got thoughts on these films, you can email truthandmovies@tcolondon.com or tweet us at LWLies. Next week, it's Wes Anderson's latest, the subject of the latest issue, Asteroid City. Nobel laureate Annie Ernaux's story is told in the Super 8 Years. And for Film Club, we return to Bad Day at Black Rock. Thanks very much for tuning in. And if you enjoyed the show, please leave us a review and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Truth and Movies is hosted by me, Leila Latif, and my guests this week were David Jenkins and Lillian Crawford. The podcast is produced by TCO London and edited by Bob Sankus.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands.
They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.